I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we discover the most important rules for business and for life from the co-founder of Fast Company magazine, Alan Weber. He's written a book that's half how-to business book and half memoir called Rules of Thumb, 52 Truths for Winning at Business Without Losing Yourself. Also with us is Dan Biederman. He's the co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation in New York, a private organization that transformed Bryant Park in the center of the city from a dangerous and depressing eyesore to one of the best loved and the most intensely used urban parks in the world. Stay with us for today's Smart City, coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alan Weber has worn many hats in his career, from working for the mayor of Portland, Oregon in the 70s, to managing and editing the Harvard Business Review, before moving on to co-found the magazine Fast Company. His latest endeavor is a hybrid business how-to and a personal memoir titled Rules of Thumb, 52 Truths for Winning at Business Without Losing Yourself. Alan, do you believe that there is an inherent conflict between winning at business and being true to yourself?
I don't think there's an inherent conflict, but I think that the way we do business in the United States tends to incite people to have to make a choice. You've hit, as usual, Carol, on one of my hobby horses. I look at what's going on in the economy in the United States today and the economic meltdown. And the debate right now is what, if you read the newspapers and even look at recent books like Robert Shiller's book on animal spirits in economics, the debate is what's wrong with our economic models. And I think that misses the point. I think our economic models are just fine. I think our management models are flawed. And in many ways, I think if you look at the last 30 or 40 years since I've been on the scene looking at business, we have had a national economic catastrophe almost on a regular basis every decade. It's as if you can set your watch by a national economic meltdown. And in every case, we make it through to the other end, whether it's junk bonds or dot-com bombs. We get out of the problem and we succeed at pulling ourselves together without learning anything from the experience. So my hope is that as a result of this current, not only national, but global economic disaster, we'll start asking questions, including and starting with, what are we teaching our MBA students that's wrong about the art of management? Why are we creating generation after generation of managers who think their first and foremost responsibility is to produce shareholder value, even at the expense of ethical behavior or their own self-image and self-realization?
Do you reject the idea, Alan, that it's all about the economic incentives? Is there something more at work there?
Well, I think the way we tend in the United States to focus, it is about economic incentives. I think in the United States, we set our default setting for success at money. We tend to calculate our personal and individual well-being by wealth. And that isn't true around the world, but it is definitely an American syndrome. And as long as we think the default way of measuring personal success and well-being is purely in financial terms, the incentives will all be set to encourage people to do whatever it takes to meet their numbers and make as much money as possible, even if it imperils other people's economic well-being or the well-being of the world's economy.
So do you think the rules that you've documented in Rules of Thumb will help make that management model more positive?
Yes, I hope so. There are several different ways to read Rules of Thumb as a book. One is simply to read the stories that accompany each of the rules, the people that taught me the lessons, and enjoy it as a collection of 52 really interesting stories. Another way to read it is to look at the so what that's at the end of each rule and try to use it as a book that can give you personal, practical, advice on how to do a better job in your own work and life and at putting the pieces together. A third way to read it is to look at the practice of keeping 3x5 cards, which was what I learned from Ted Levitt that went into creating this book over the last 25, 30 years, writing down on little 3x5 cards the lessons of life and business that you hear on a day-to-day basis and be more engaged in your own education. And then I think there is a fourth level, and that is if you read these rules over a period of time, you'll begin to see a pattern emerge about a different attitude toward work and life, a different way of keeping score, a different way of working with others and of making your own work experience more innovative, creative, and satisfying. I'm trying to weave together, without being too preachy or too much of a scold, I'm trying to weave together a different mindset that has certainly served me well. I think it served Fast Company readers well over the years that Bill Taylor and I started Fast Company and then ran it. And in many ways, it served the best of the Harvard Business Review well, in the sense that the best authors, the most creative writers for the Harvard Business Review, understood that there was more to work than just having a big job title or a huge salary. So I'm trying to weave together those levels of reading this book and sneak in some philosophy at the same time.
You mentioned your founding of Fast Company magazine and your work at the Harvard Business Review. And, of course, you've written this book among the many other things you've done. And you have a rule in here. I love it. Ask the last question first. And, of course, the last question is, what does victory look like? Have you always been so clear about what it was you were trying to achieve?
Oh, I wish. No, there are simple answers to all of these questions, Carol. No would be the simple answer. But that is a good rule. And I didn't learn it until we started Fast Company. Actually, in the beta issue of Fast Company, the trial issue, we had our first big idea essay written by a friend of mine named Mark Fuller, who was the founder, one of the founders of Monitor Consulting Firm. And in that essay, Mark wrote about business as war. That was actually the title of the piece, Business as War. It's still on the Fast Company website if you look up the archives. In it, he noted that if you look at the history of the United States' disastrous experience in war in Vietnam, it was a situation where the United States military didn't lose a single battle and yet lost the war. And he asked the question, how did that happen? And his answer was, they didn't have a clear definition of victory. And in the absence of a clear definition of victory, it's very hard to know not only whether you've won, but why you're fighting in the first place. So I'm encouraging entrepreneurs, business people, politicians, government officials, before you launch on a new project, before you undertake something that you are going to put an enormous amount of time and energy and money into, ask the last question first. And the last question is, what's our definition of victory? What's the point of the exercise? Why are we doing this in the first place? And if you can't answer that question, you really have to go back to first principles and say, why am I doing this? What is my definition of victory? What is driving me to try to undertake this project? In the absence of clarity, you're really never going to know not only whether you've won, but whether you're applying the right resources, whether you're bringing the right people into the project, how hard you should work, when you should give up, if you need to give up. All of these things are derivative of knowing why you're doing it in the first place.
Alan, I think every time I've read your work or had an opportunity to talk with you, it's always been so timely. It's always come at just the right moment for me. And I could talk about all 52 of these rules, but I want to just ask you quickly about three of them. Learn to take no as a question. What do you mean?
You're picking on some of my favorite rules, Carol, so it sounds like you and I are of the same mind. Not that I don't love all of my rules equally. They're like children, you know. They're all wonderful. Learn to take no as a question is really, again, teed up in this book as an entrepreneur's challenge. I was in San Francisco trying to raise money for a new project, a social business that I want to start. And a friend of mine in Austria had set up a meeting with one of his best friends to get him to put money into the deal. The dinner was perfect. The wines were sparkling. It was a great evening. There was only one problem. The guy who was supposed to say yes said no. He wasn't going to put any money into this deal, and he proceeded to ask a bunch of questions about my idea. And as he asked each question, I knew I wasn't giving very good answers. But the more he asked these questions, the more I knew he was doing me a favor, because he was really not only saying no, he was challenging me to think harder and clearer and with more tough-mindedness to my own project. Rather than thinking that a friend could simply tee up an investment, I had to deal with the fact that I hadn't done the hard work of getting my own idea in shape. Well, my takeaway from that was that entrepreneurs are going to hear the word no a lot. We all hear it a lot, whether you're an entrepreneur starting a new business, you're a social entrepreneur trying to begin a new adventure that you think will contribute to making society a better place, or you're in a company and you want to pioneer a new idea inside a company, you're going to hear no quite a bit. The question is, how do you take it? If you take it personally, if you take it as a put down or an insult or the last word, you're probably going to walk away as a very unhappy entrepreneur. If you learn to take no as a question, you're going to listen in to the reasons that somebody tells you no and take it as a challenge to think harder about your own idea. And you're going to take it as a welcome challenge, because while your friends will often praise your idea and sometimes do it without really giving it much thought, somebody who tells you no is doing you the huge favor of taking your idea seriously and giving you tough-minded feedback. And that's the only way to make your own idea better.
Maybe the truest rule in the book is everyone's at the center of their map of the world. What are the implications of that?
I love that rule because it kind of riffs off Tom Friedman and The World is Flat and looks at the world in a slightly different way. That story dates back to my sitting on an airplane getting ready in 1989 to fly to Japan for 3 months as a fellow from the Japan Society of New York. And I knew it was going to be a long airplane ride. I don't know if you do this or not, but when I'm about to have a long airplane ride, I like to take out the map that's in the book in the seat back and see exactly where my route is going to take me. So I opened up the Japan Airlines book and looked for the route. And I was flying New York to Tokyo, but I couldn't even find New York on the map until I looked more carefully and realized that on American maps, New York is on the right-hand side of North America. In a Japanese map, it's all upside down and backward. New York is on the left-hand side of the map because that way Japan gets to be at the center of the map. And it hit me that I was really getting my first lesson in geopolitics. Sitting on the plane, looking at this map, I realized only in the United States is the United States always at the middle of the world map. Probably in every other country in the world, that country is in the middle of the map of the world. And that's true as a metaphor for how we need to look at business and a global economy and also our own work lives. In the old days, if you wanted to be in the advertising business, you had to go to Madison Avenue. That was the center of the world. If you wanted to be in the auto industry, you had to go to Detroit. That was the center of the map of the world. If you were in fashion, Milan was the only place to get your ticket punched, and so on. There was one place that was the center of the world for every industry. Well, that game is over, and now it's about talent. It's about connections. It's about being where you think you want to be to make the contribution you want to make. You don't have to go to New York to be a star in advertising. You can be in Portland, Oregon, and work with some of the most interesting and exciting firms in the world. If you want to be in the fashion business, you can go to Brazil, go to São Paulo, and be a brilliant fashion designer. So it's less the way it used to be, that there's one right place for everything. Now we need to look at a world of global economics, of technologically enabled communication, and realize everybody is at the center of their part of the world, and the game is make connections, work well with others, and make the best use of your talent, regardless of where you're located.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with author and co-founder of Fast Company magazine, Alan Weber. We're talking about the 52 business strategies and life lessons in his book, Rules of Thumb. You have a couple of rules that I guess are my favorites in the book. Great leaders answer Tom Peters' great question, how can I capture the world's imagination? And if you want to make change, start with an iconic project. You've mentioned your work as a co-founder of Fast Company magazine, and I know that you started Fast Company with a manifesto. It always felt like Fast Company was serving a movement. It was more than a magazine. Looking back on that experience of developing, starting with that manifesto, how would you assess its value to the enterprise?
You got it exactly right. When Bill Taylor and I were imagining Fast Company, I remember writing in our business plan, we said, great magazines serve a great purpose. And in our case, we did go further and say, this isn't just a magazine, this is a movement. We had an agenda. We had a philosophy. We led off in the first issue of the magazine by almost having a manifesto on the cover. Work is personal, we said. Knowledge is power. Computing is social. These were powerful ideas in 1995. 14, 15 years later, we may take them for granted as social media has swept across the web, and we've seen that technology really connects people and knowledge is the basis of the economy, and the best companies are the ones that are built out of the talent of their people rather than seeking merely to maximize economic value. But in 1995, those were really quite revolutionary articles to post on our magazine's cover. It really did serve us well to start with that kind of philosophy. And I actually hadn't made the connection to the Tom Peters rule of how can I capture the world's imagination. But in effect, that's what we were doing. We were shaking our fists at the gods of magazining and saying, we're going to do something that makes a difference or we're going to, you know, die trying. And better to shoot for the best we can possibly be and for something that transcends the boundaries of narrow magazining and really make a statement. And if we can find other people who feel that passionate about business and about work, then we will have a community of people who really want to contribute to creating change and making a difference. And the same is true, I would say, about the one you like about making change by starting with iconic projects. You, I know, are first and foremost a student of leadership in cities. And that rule really goes back to an experience I had when I was working in Portland, Oregon, for the mayor of Portland. And this was back in the 1970s, when Portland was really kind of a backwater. It's hard to imagine now because Portland, Oregon shows up at least once a month, if not more often, in the New York Times as America's most walkable city or most bicyclable city or most environmentally advanced city. But back then, when I showed up in Portland, it was almost a city that was trapped in the 1950s. And through a series of leadership efforts led by Neil Goldschmidt and with a community of neighborhood activists, Portland really pulled itself together, didn't build the network of freeways that Robert Moses had drawn on the map for the city's future, and instead invested in mass transit. But the most iconic project involved downtown Portland. The city went through the process of developing a downtown plan. It had outside consultants. It had a citizens advisory committee that put together a series of recommendations. The city council, with great debate over did it or didn't it believe in limiting parking downtown? Would it make sense to close off Harbor Drive on the waterfront and turn it into a park? All of these things were debated with great passion, and it was really a debate about two business models. One was the business model for the status quo of what cities had always been, and the other was a business model of innovation and creativity for what a city could be. At the end of the day, the forces of change won, and we got the downtown plan adopted. Great. Now you have a plan, but how do you implement it? And I'll never forget what happened was Neil Goldschmidt, as the mayor, went up to Seattle, sat down with the Nordstrom family, worked through a very careful economic project for the Nordstroms to invest in the first new downtown department store in decades in Portland, Oregon. And when the announcement was made that the Nordstrom family believed enough in downtown Portland and the downtown plan to build a new, modern, clean, up-to-date Nordstrom's with all that that brand means in terms of customer service and quality, they were going to invest in the downtown plan. That iconic project changed the downtown plan from wishful thinking to a reality. And I believe the same is true in companies. You may have a brilliant marketing strategy. Start with one piece that you can implement as an iconic piece that can make it real so people know you're not just wishing great thoughts. And I've seen that happen in business, in government, in not-for-profits. One small statement, if it is iconic and powerful, can transform a conversation that sounds like wishful thinking into a new model that really produces change.
Because you've always been so good at mining the drivers of change, Alan, I want to ask, do you see any developing trend or trends today likely to dramatically affect the way we live and work?
I think there are quite a few, Carol, that are really powerful. There are four things that are going on that are changing the world, and then there are some subsets to those that I'll try to hit really quickly. In 1989, I went to Japan, and the four things I saw then in 89, 20 years later, are having a revival and a revitalization. They're coming around the merry-go-round, but they're in version 2.0 or 3.0. Let me tick those off really quickly. The first is technology. In 89, the digital revolution was just coming out of the great technology companies of Japan and the United States. Today, we're seeing versions 2.0, 3.0. Technology is radically changing how companies work, how we all work, how we communicate, how we connect. Second was globalization. In 89, Japan was at the peak of its bubble. It was probably the richest country on earth. Today, we're looking at what Goldman Sachs dubbed BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, as the four global economic powers that we need to track. I think the world may or may not be flat, and we all may be at the center of it, but there are definitely changing global economic trends that need to be minded and taken into consideration. The third was a generational shift. In 89, it was Bill Clinton becoming president, George Bush Sr., and the World War II generation shuffling off the leadership stage, being replaced by baby boomers. 20 years later, it's the baby boomers shuffling off the stage, and Barack Obama in his 40s and people in their 20s and 30s stepping up to leadership positions. They have different experiences, different mindsets, different expectations. And the fourth one in 89 that is even more powerful today is diversity. What I noticed in Japan, and when I got back from Japan to the U.S., was that most American business magazines in 89 were still putting white men facing right on their covers, as if that was the face of business. Today, the face of business is black, white, brown, yellow. It's male, female. It's gay. It is global. It is all different shapes, colors, varieties, religions. It's coming from various mindsets. There is no one-size-fits-all. I was with Dan Pink in Washington, D.C. about a week ago, and Dan pointed out that we haven't had a white male Secretary of State since Warren Christopher held the job maybe 15 years ago. the Secretary of State, if you were to pick one job in the United States that used to belong to the most pinstriped person in America, that was the job. And yet now it belongs to people who are black, who are female, who are black and female. We're seeing diversity absolutely change the game of business. So those are four trends that I think are incredibly powerful. I'd mention two others very quickly. One is, in the generational shift, young people today are so different from the way I was when I was 20, 25, 30. They are already global. They are already comfortable with a world of diversity. They are already at home with technology. They are fearless in their willingness to espouse causes that make change happen. They are much more interested in making a difference than in making money. They see the importance of contributing to the world, of trying to make it a better place, and they are absolutely fearless and proud to talk about their values. They don't hide from anything when it comes to talking about what matters to them. That is really hopeful. And the second thing I would point out is the blurring of lines that used to exist in categories that we took for granted. In the old model of how the world works, we're used to thinking in terms of business, government, and not-for-profits as three very separate categories. And today, we're witnessing those categories becoming so jumbled, they look more like a Rubik's Cube of change. When the government of the United States is the largest shareholder in General Motors and in banks and Wall Street, we know that government is no longer simply about setting rules and being a hands-off player in the economy. When Starbucks spends more money on healthcare than it does on coffee beans, we know that companies are deeply invested in social change and the business of human beings having good lives. It's not just the government that does that. So I see those lines blurring. I see categories being reinvented, and I see talented, committed, bright young people picking up the torch and absolutely committing themselves to making a difference in the world. Those are trends and developments that I think are going to continue for the next 20 years as we watch the merry-go-round again.
Alan, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks, Carol. It's great to visit with you.
Alan Weber is the author of the book, Rules of Thumb, 52 Truths for Winning at Business Without Losing Yourself. For more information on Alan's book, go to our website at smartcityradio.com. Coming up after the break, we'll get the latest from Plan Edison, and we'll talk to Dan Biederman of the Bryant Park Corporation about transforming New York City's Bryant Park into one of the hottest spots in the city. I'm Carol Coletta. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online, and now back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
City rankings are always contentious, whether it's the best places to live or the worst places to find a job. Another of the more disliked lists, among cities anyways, is the ranking of the most dangerous cities. But ranking entire cities by crime is often a misrepresentation of their actual crime rates. Some neighborhoods within a city can have very high rates of crime, while others have none. To make the picture a little more accurate, the websites WalletPop.com and Neighborhood Scout have reviewed FBI data from the nation's 17,000 local law enforcement agencies to identify the specific neighborhoods that have the highest rates and risks of crime. According to their report, the neighborhood near Central Parkway and Liberty Street in Cincinnati, Ohio, is the nation's most dangerous, where residents have a 1 in 4 chance of being a victim of crime in 1 year. One city that's nowhere on that list is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But based on a recent policy decision, you might think it was one of the most dangerous cities in the world. About 165 closed-circuit security cameras will soon start rolling, capturing most activity in the city's streets, parks, and public spaces. According to a recent article from the Los Angeles Times, Lancaster has a fairly average rate of crime. But rising poverty and an increase in gang activity in and around the city has convinced a local crime commission that security cameras may be necessary to deter crime. And though many cities across the world have security cameras, the 165 planned for Lancaster are more than many other U.S. cities with greater populations than Lancaster's 55,000. Though sanctioned by the city, the actual task of monitoring the streets has been outsourced to a private company, which will notify police when criminal activity is seen. Some citizens have threatened to move out of the city, but for the most part, the cameras have sparked little outrage. Meanwhile, America's big cities are feeling a little left out. A recent report from the U.S. Conference of Mayors has criticized the federal government's distribution of stimulus money, arguing that the nation's smaller cities are receiving a disproportionately high amount of transportation money from the stimulus plan. The report says that 85 of the most populous metros have received only $8.8 billion of the $18 billion set aside for transportation. That's less than half of the available funding, while these areas account for nearly two-thirds of the nation's population. The mayors argue that the stimulus money should break with tradition and flow directly to cities rather than state governments for more appropriate distribution. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Bryant Park is a 9-acre public park in the heart of New York City. In the 70s and 80s, it had a bad reputation. No, a terrible reputation as a dangerous place to go. But Dan Biederman changed all that. He's the co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation and Grand Central Partnership and the 34th Street Partnership, all business improvement districts, or BIDs, in New York. And in his role at the Bryant Park Corporation, he turned the park from a no-go zone to one of the most popular urban parks in the world. What a pleasure it is to talk with the person who gave us such a wonderful, wonderful public space as Bryant Park in New York City. What was your original vision for Bryant Park?
Well, one of the first things I did when I was hired was to look for models, and we looked at Rockefeller Center in New York, which pleased a lot of people, and the public spaces around the Rouse facilities in Boston and Baltimore, and also Disney, even though it was private and you had to pay to get in, they were clearly pleasing a lot of people. So the vision really was get rid of all the bad things in the park at the time, drugs, graffiti, crime, serious crime. There were murders and rapes and robberies there galore. And make the park clean and safe, and then program it. And the vision was a new town square for Midtown Manhattan right at the heart of the Central Business District.
What was it you learned from these models that you studied at Disney and Rouse and Rockefeller Center?
They clearly paid a lot of attention to detail. Retail was not a bad thing to put in urban spaces. There was much unhappiness when we proposed that we would do some food retail in Bryant Park, but it only occupies less than 5% of all the total land. And programming, things to make people come to the park, even in weather that's not perfect, because you have very few perfect weather days in Bryant Park. You might have 30 or 40 each year where the weather's just exquisite. You got to keep your clientele coming back when it's a little warmer or when there's a wind and it's a little cool in the fall. So we program very carefully based on some of the things we learned from other places. But obviously, we've been running this park now for 18 years, so we've learned a lot and we've come up with a lot of new ideas ourselves.
What are the most important things you've learned about running a successful park that others can learn from?
First thing is your female customer is your most important customer. If you please women, you will please everyone. Because women note dirt and they know danger much more than males do. Males will sit down next to a dangerous person and not even notice. Males will sit down with litter and the like. So we said we can't have that. We also have to have very good restrooms for them because they let us know that. So we made the park exquisitely clean. And we made the restrooms unusually luxurious and well-managed and clean. And we picked up paper, frequently eliminated any traces of graffiti, and then programmed with events that would draw female clientele, whether it's the arts or literature. Horticulture is an important part of the park. too, and we have a special appeal to gardeners. There are 67 million amateur gardeners in the United States, and we seem to have a good portion of them because they ask us questions about the flowers we have.
What have been your biggest challenges?
Well, to get it going, politics was the big challenge. New York is not a city that's friendly to private management, or the word privatization is almost a dirty word here. So what we were proposing was to take this park out of the public sector and move it into the private to some extent. We still New York City land, but it's really run by a private corporation. So that was the initial challenge. The challenge since has been to react to events occasionally, different mayors, still some politics, but also to keep it fresh. We really have made a great effort to keep the park complex, evolving, improving each year. We've done that with new programs, with new ideas from elsewhere that we see, new ideas we generate. And one of my joys now is to go into the park and be behind a person who's explaining to a visitor how the park works. And it takes them a while. They wave their arms. They point in different directions. They say, let me explain to you what happens over there normally. They're not there today, but normally there's this and that. So it's really terrific that the park is a complex experience that people feel that they haven't gotten the hang of yet, and they keep coming back for more.
What do you mean by keeping the park complex?
As you walk on one of the paths, you will see an ever-changing group of events. You might see one day just a simple reading room, which is something no one else does, but we pioneered it. It's an outdoor library, in effect, in the park, and you can borrow the books and sit there and read magazines, newspapers, and the like. The next day, the library will still be there, but there will be an event with a well-known author who is describing his or her book and signing copies of it, just as might happen in a Barnes & Noble or a Borders. A little on beyond that, and there's some chess players who have made a little enclave for themselves under a certain tree, and there are six or eight different speed chess games going on, and they move around. And further, you're getting to the area where most people are on the web access system, Wi-Fi, where they're doing work, and they've stayed out of their office and decided to stay longer in the afternoon because it's a nice day. So you've got all kinds of little things going on that change, and we work incredibly carefully to make sure these details appeal so that this will be the town center for the business district, and therefore the crowds are very large.
Dan, how do you manage physical encroachments on the park? How many are too many? I was there a few weeks ago during Fashion Week and couldn't get into the park. So how do you know when too much is indeed too much?
We don't have too many of them, first, Carol. And second, the city has agreed with us that eventually, because Fashion Week has grown so much, it's a wonderful event, but they need a bigger space and a more established flat, hard surface to be underneath them. So eventually they will find another home for it quite soon, we hope. That's really the only event of its kind. The most of the other events that are have any kind of private tinge to them are mostly concerts and the like in film series paid for by private parties, where a promotion of a product might be incidental, but the main thing is the public's being entertained. Fashion is not open to the public, but there really aren't many of them. And by the way, while they're there, a large part of the park is still open to the public, and people just move their operations from the lawn to the surrounding, what we call LAs, where the trees are. And they operate in chairs and tables underneath the trees, much as they would if the lawn were open to them.
Why couldn't the city do Bryant Park on its own?
Well, the city people are actually quite smart and have emulated a number of things we've done. At the time we took Bryant Park over, the city was just coming out of its fiscal crisis. So it was a question partly of resources. Partly, they had 1,500 other parks, and it's hard to, when you've got such a big empire, to pay as much attention to a few of them. We subsequently went on and did two others. Herald and Greeley Square is down at 34th Street as part of our BID there. So we only run three of roughly now, I think, 1,700 parks in their empire. So it's a matter of focus and closeness to the customer, because we really know the people who surround the park, who would use it. We get support from their companies. So for a lot of reasons, it would have been hard for the city to do it exactly as we did. But the city, to its credit, has really emulated our techniques, and they've come up with a lot of their own, and they've done a very nice job in several other parks that serve business districts.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dan Biederman. He is co-founder of the Bryant Park Corporation and a number of other business improvement districts in New York City. You've now developed business improvement districts in cities around the country. What makes a business improvement district work?
Much the same as with parks that we've done. BIDs allow the business community to focus on the things that they know to be wrong with their neighborhood and put added resources into them that they can control through a small board of directors rather than going through the city's budget process. So a building will pay anywhere from a few hundred dollars a year to several hundred thousand dollars a year into a fund managed by what's called a business improvement district with a director like me who will spend that money on enhanced services and then some programs that the city would not think of providing because it's beyond their scope given their cost base. We've done that at 34th Street and Grand Central in New York, now in Chelsea on a more informal basis, not technically a BID. We were early. We weren't the first, but it's been copied in many, many places. The budgets range from as little as a couple hundred thousand dollars a year to as much as 12 or 14 million a year.
If business improvement districts or BIDs work so well, why doesn't the city just turn over all of its parks to BIDs?
Well, there are many of the city's parks are in neighborhoods that wouldn't allow that. They're, the bulk of the assets in those neighborhoods are not big enough to pay for much added service. That's one thing. Second, there are residential district parks, and the city, for its own reasons, I don't agree with them, has traditionally discouraged districts being created in residential neighborhoods. They are called business improvement districts, and they've taken that at the city council to mean that they shouldn't encourage the growth of these in residential neighborhoods. And I would say at least 3/4 of the city's parks are really in residential districts rather than business districts. So for all those reasons, there are only a few parks that benefit from BID expenditures.
Are there things you can do, Dan, that you know you can do that will most assuredly lead to higher real estate values?
Well, you start, as we did, with clean and safe. And that's become a mantra for most BIDs in the country. We've gone way beyond that because our third keyword was words were capital plant. We looked at the capital plant and Grand Central Partnership when we worked there, and we said the city has not invested in this capital plant in decades. We need to fix it. So we replaced every single thing: lampposts, signs, trees, corners, newspaper boxes. And that was all with privately raised money through a bond issue backed by the credit of the Business Improvement District. It was those things that really turned the neighborhood around. We've gone on to add 5, 6, 8 other programs, but that's a good way to start. Clean, safe, and attractive. And attractiveness applies not only to the storefronts, but also to the public realm, as we call it, which includes all those capital improvements.
Are there times when a business improvement district just doesn't work?
Yeah, I'd say the cases where districts don't work include not enough money, not the right leadership, board battles, sometimes too much interference by the city. That happened here. It's happened in many other cities. I'd say there are plenty of districts where they're not achieving as much as they might. Interestingly, though, the property owners usually vote to continue them. So they feel the situation with the districts is better than it was before they started.
How do you work out the relationships between the BID and the city? You've talked about the mayor's office, but what about the city departments like police and sanitation in particular?
The line agencies tend to be easy to work with, police and sanitation, yeah. There isn't a large amount of jealousy or unhappiness. They've got their hands full with all kinds of crises, and they're happy to have the help. Agencies that involve design are usually tougher. Our relationship with the Department of Transportation in New York City is up and down. It's currently up. We have a commissioner who's pushing through a lot of pedestrian and green type initiatives very quickly and is happy to work with us. And this is the most productive relationship we've ever had with them. But there are times when highway engineers and sign specialists in the agency can be reluctant to work with the business improvement districts.
You mentioned earlier that you put together the Chelsea Improvement Company to redevelop the public realm and the block surrounding Chelsea Market. What opportunity did you see there, and what opportunity did the owners see there for private management of the public realm?
Well, it's a fascinating district. It's about 20 blocks from the center of Midtown Manhattan. But in Southwest Chelsea, you had some very interesting retail. And Chelsea Market is a fascinating building cobbled together from 14 individual small buildings by a very creative property owner, Irwin Cohen, back about a decade ago. The problem was, outside those buildings, it still looked like the manufacturing district it used to be. And you had situations where people would be there at night enjoying the four new classy restaurants that are there, walking on totally dark streets and not knowing where they were going. These are 25-year-old women in stiletto heels, all dressed up, ready to go to a club. And we said, you know, this is a dangerous situation because it's dark as can be here, and people are eventually going to know there's an opportunity. So even though street crime is not a big issue in New York anymore, we saw a potential for some of it down there. So we had to start just as we did up in Midtown further, picking up litter, removing all the graffiti, increasing the light levels, adding some security, and working on the parks and public spaces. And now an entirely new streetscape is being proposed to the city. They haven't agreed to it all yet. We're having trouble, as we did with Grand Central and 34th Street, pushing it slowly through the regulatory procedures. But we'll get there, I think.
Why would the city resist improved streets?
There are design review agencies in the city that have their own views about separate vocabularies of streetscape from those put out on the street by the city of New York. So that's one of the principal issues. And then some of the Department of Transportation people have their own ideas about how this stuff ought to look. So it's not unfriendly. It's just different views have to be reconciled to get all our stuff approved and out there.
What's in it for the city to allow business improvement districts?
Mainly added service without any cost to the taxpayers or any further drain on the managerial resources of the city. So they usually do cooperate very well. As I said, there have been cases where city managers or mayors have terminated BIDs, not cooperated with them, interfered in the management of day-to-day. But generally, across the country, it's been a pretty positive picture.
Explain the difference between a BID, a business improvement district, and a TIF, a tax increment financing option.
Well, BIDs, it's a add-on charge to real estate tax charges placed on any individual building. And you can choose to build capital improvements based on the ongoing stream of revenue. Very few districts have done that. We've been four out of the five, I think, that have been done in the country that way. TIFs are totally different. That's commitment by the city to assign any added taxes that come in as a result of a new development project, not to the general revenue of that city, but to building improvements that will encourage that development to be successful. So that can be streetscape, it can be park, highway expenditures, and TIFs have been very, very big in Illinois. They don't work at all in New York. There's never been a successful TIF that I'm aware of in New York State. So it's amazing how the states differ.
Have you done research that shows changes in surrounding real estate value as a result of a business improvement district?
Our best piece on that is a park-based piece of research. The accounting firm Ernst & Young did a very solid piece based on analysis of asking rents in the Bryant Park neighborhood versus other pieces of the city during a period from 1991 to actually early 00s, and showed huge increases in asking rents and therefore value created by the presence of Bryant Park. And all you need to back that up with anecdotal experience is look at the real estate ads, which inevitably say just steps from Bryant Park, overlooking Bryant Park. This is the last thing people wanted to boast about 20 years ago when the park was still lousy. But things are being named after us all over the place, a hotel, a restaurant, an office building that's the biggest green building in the United States, One Bryant Park, put up by the Durst family with Bank of America. So in addition to making people want to simply live there more, there's real and work there. There's more brand equity from the name Bryant Park than you can imagine.
Dan, you received the Manhattan Institute's first Lifetime Achievement Award for social entrepreneurship. You've done such a wonderful job with parks and public improvements in the city of New York. Are there other problem areas in the public realm that you'd like to tackle where you see an opportunity for innovation?
Yeah, I would. I view social entrepreneurship differently than many others, including actually they teach it at Harvard Business School where I went, but they teach a different version of it than I believe in. I think social entrepreneurship is taking business techniques from the private sector and applying them to public problems. Sometimes social entrepreneurship is just defined as people who've decided to be innovative in the nonprofit sector. I don't think that's social entrepreneurship. So the most promising routes, I think, in the country to develop social entrepreneurship are with operations that the public sector has written off as economically feasible. Example, the old saw that every mass transit can never break even or make money. It's complete nonsense, but it doesn't right now. Why? Because every mass transit agency in the country is run by the public sector, and the public sector overpays on the expense side and undercharges very often on the revenue side. I could give you examples of that. So naturally, the profit and loss statement shows a huge deficit. And then the image gets created that mass transit always has to lose money. It doesn't. It could be run by the private sector at a wash or better, even after an investment in improved facilities. But that it's a very hard case to make because it's been decades and decades of the old views of this being accepted.
Dan, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City and for the work you do in New York.
Thank you very much.
Dan Biederman is the president of the Bryant Park Corporation. He joined us from his office in New York City, and his interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. Finally this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith delves deep into the lexicon to discover when our economic woes went from bad to great.
Things are bad right now in the economy. Really bad. Really bad. Getting better in many ways, but still bad. Yet we're not in the midst of anything like the Great Depression or an economic depression of any sort. It's just a recession, which is not much comfort, actually, because analysts and commentators of all sorts, including the International Monetary Fund, have started using the term the Great Recession to characterize this downturn. The increasing use of this phrase, the Great Recession, piqued the curiosity of Catherine Rample, who is the economics editor of the New York Times. She wanted to know who coined the phrase and when it was first used. So she did a search of publications using Nexus and found that this phrase has been circulating since January 2008, well before the National Bureau of Economic Research determined this recession began in December 2007. Usage of this term picked up between May and November, but then spiked significantly in December 2008 and has remained high ever since. That's when the phrase really caught on, so every story and report since then has used it. It seems to have the proper sense of gravity and severity. It seems to accurately capture what we're experiencing. This phrase indeed seems to fit the nature of our times and the economic difficulties of the moment. It puts the right name to what we have come to regard as a unique period in our history, just like the phrase the Great Depression put the right name to those unique times. But is this phrase really what it seems to be? Because the other thing that Catherine Rample found, much to her surprise, is that this recession is by no means the first since the Great Depression to be characterized in this way. In fact, what really appears to be the case is that any time we're in tough economic straits, we start calling it the Great Recession. Economists use that very phrase for the 2001 recession that started prior to 9/11. The recession of 1990-91 was described with this phrase, particularly the impact of that recession on the state of Connecticut. The double-dip recession of 1980-82 was popularly known in this way, as was the 16-month recession of 1973-75 before it. Forbes magazine declared that 1979 was the Great Recession, even though the National Bureau of Economic Research never declared a recession in that year. And Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman used this phrase to describe the economic crises of the 1990s in the original edition of his recently republished book, The Return of Depression Economics. If there's one thing we don't lack, it's great recessions. Apparently, we've had plenty of them, not just this one. Now, I mention this not to make light of the hard times we're in. We are facing a severe downturn, and one that has set many new record lows and has declined with unprecedented speed. I only mention this to urge us to keep some perspective on what we're experiencing. If we convince ourselves that this recession has changed things forever, because after all, it is the Great Recession, quote-unquote, then we are likely to do things about it that might be unwise, and we are likely to make plans in anticipation of developments that will simply not come true. Times are hard, but let's not go overboard. Recessions end, the economy recovers, and we go back to our lives. Our lives are changed, but they are not transported from here to Mars. We will make our way forward again. We will come back from this just as we have come back from every great recession before. And we will thrive in the future, notwithstanding the fact that I am sure we will see yet another great recession again. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Group. That's all for this week's show, but there's more Smart City on our website. Head to smartcityradio.com, subscribe to our podcast to hear an extended version of my interview with Alan Weber. While you're there, sign up for the newsletter, read my blog, get in touch with us, let us know how we're doing. You can send email to questions@smartcityradio.com, or you can reach out through Twitter at @ccoletta. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our handwritten producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.